sahanavavatu, sahanau bhunaktu, sahavidyan karavavahai, tejasvinavadhitamastu mavidvishavahai. Om shanti shanti shantihi.
Very good. Welcome to you all. We have a very nice topic planned for our meditation session and a very profound technique that we'll perform together in just a few minutes. The discussion is based on our study of the Mahabharata, which the current chapter is this wonderful exploration of the teachings that every person has a divine nature, the divinity that dwells within each person. Now, many of you will take this particular teaching for granted. After all, you've heard this from the time you were a child, that your true nature is divine. There's actually a problem in taking that for granted, because when you do, it's like, okay, so my true nature is divine, so what? Your true nature is divine, so what? So what means then I don't have to treat you like a divine person, nor do I have to take care of myself like a divine person. Just a brief observation. I think a few of you, including myself, were not raised in Hindu families. And from that perspective, you have a much deeper appreciation for the profundity and uniqueness of this teaching about man's fundamental divine nature, because you know that the other of the great world's religious traditions, the biblical traditions, none of them hold that your true nature is divine. In fact, the biblical traditions hold that your true nature is flawed, corrupt, sinful. And when you develop a system of ethics and morality based on the assumption that your true nature is evil and corrupt, you can imagine that that assumption is going to be reflected throughout the religious teachings and throughout the ethic moral systems that evolved. We are so blessed to have a tradition that says the opposite. Your true nature is perfect, pure, complete, whole, full, in a word, divine. Now, these words, of course, full, complete, divine, are simple English words, but they're all reflections of a central teaching of Vedanta, a central teaching of the great rishis. In fact, their main teaching. The main teaching of the great rishis could be summarized in the four Mahavakyas, which are known to you all. Tattvamasi, you are that. You are what? Divine. Aham Brahmasmi, I am Brahman. I am divine. Prajnanam Brahma, prajnanam, the consciousness that abides in my mind, is Brahman, is divine. I am Atma Brahma. This Atma, this consciousness, this self which I am, is Brahman, is divine. Brahman is a word that the ancient rishis used to describe the source of all, the reality because of which everything exists, what other religions would simply call God. So this very profound teaching is absolutely at the heart of this Vedic tradition. And it's then reflected very casually in this word, in this language, your true nature is divine. So let's explore, how does meditation relate to these important teachings? These teachings are the epitome, the climax of the teachings of the ancient rishis, which means you don't hear Tattvamasi and get it, oh yeah, yeah, right, I got that. It doesn't work like that. It's not something you pick up very simply and easily, like when you were learning your math tables, 2 plus 2 is 4, etc. this is a very profound discovery, and it's a discovery which we could say goes on at three different levels, and I'd like to just briefly discuss those three different levels with regard to this discovery that your true nature is divine. So the first of the three levels we'll call Shraddha, faith. The second, Vidya, it means knowledge, but it implies discovery. And the third, Nishta, we'll call that assimilation. Let's first understand what these three levels are, and then we'll look at how meditation can address each of the three. Shraddha, faith. Everything begins with faith. If you didn't have faith, you wouldn't be here today. You wouldn't consider any kind of scriptural study or attending any kind of pravachan like this. Faith implies, shraddha is a better word than faith, implies an openness of mind, a willingness to explore, a willingness to set aside your conclusions and consider that maybe what the ancient rishis said was right. Just to make this point a little clear, when you look in the mirror, I've used this metaphor many times, when you look in the mirror, do you see divinity staring back at you? Now, it seems counterintuitive. The ancient rishis said you're divine. You look in the mirror, you don't see divinity. So what would be your conclusion? Will you conclude that the rishis must have been wrong? Or will you conclude, maybe I'm wrong? That conclusion, maybe I'm wrong, is what's expressed in Shraddha. Maybe I'm wrong. Maybe what the ancient rishis said was true. Maybe I need to explore this further and find out. That's where the path of spiritual growth begins. And as Sri Krishna says in the Bhagavad Gita, Shraddhavan labhate jnanam. One who has Shraddha, labhate, gains, can gain jnanam, knowledge, or vidya. Shraddha leads to knowledge. Shraddha leads to discovery. And here's a very important observation. It means Shraddha, faith, is not the goal. It's a means to an end. When the ancient rishis said tattvamasi, they didn't mean for you to believe it. It's not a matter of belief. It's a matter of understanding, a matter of discovery. When you were learning 2 + 2 = 4, did your teacher tell you, you have to believe that 2 + 2 = 4? That's not a matter of belief. That's something you understand. In the same way, when the rishis said tattvamasi, they never intended for you just to swallow it, just to accept it, just to accept it on blind faith. Andhavishwasa. Andhavishwasa, blind faith, has a very different meaning than Shraddha. Shraddha is a willingness to explore, a desire to find out. Blind faith, in my opinion, is the enemy of true religion and spirituality. Blind faith is the ruin of many religious people and spiritual people. Blind faith is horribly insufficient. The reason it's insufficient is it gets shaky. It gets weak. You can't count on it. You can't build your religious and spiritual life on a weak foundation. Andhavishwasa, blind faith, is an incredibly weak foundation. It'll never sustain a lifelong spiritual pursuit. Never. Okay. So Shraddha is not andhavishwasa. It's not blind faith, but it's rather a sense of openness and trust. Openness to discover and trust in the Shastra, the teachings, and the Guru, the teachers. Trust that you can make the discovery with the help of the scriptures and Guru. This then culminates in vidya, knowledge. Sri Krishna says, Shraddhavan labhate jnanam. One who has faith gains knowledge. Jnanam or vidya, they're synonyms. And on the board, I've written discovery instead of knowledge. Knowledge is the most literal translation for jnanam or vidya. But I hesitate to use the word knowledge because we tend to use knowledge in a sense of information. When you open up a book full of all kinds of knowledge, what you really mean, it's a book full of all kinds of information. Lots of stuff that you learn about. You open up a book on physics, you learn a lot about particles. You open up a book on medicine, you learn a lot about the human body. You open up a book on Vedanta, it's completely different. A physics book is full of information. Let me put it this way. In the physics book, the information is what's important. In the medical book, the information is what's important. In Vedantic books, in our shastras, in our scriptures, the information that's there is secondary. It's not the point. It's not the point of reading the scripture is not to get all that information, but rather to use those teachings for the sake of discovering something about yourself. A metaphor I've used before, and a very helpful metaphor, it's like the difference between that physics book and a road map. In the physics book, the information in the book is what's important. On the roadmap, there's a lot of information on the roadmap. Is that what's important about the roadmap? When you're lost, you pick up the roadmap and just go on it memorizing all the details of the map, getting all the information off the map. You get the point that on the roadmap, it's not the information that's a goal. The goal is to use that roadmap to lead you to a destination. The roadmap is full of information, but that information in and of itself is not the goal. The goal in using a roadmap is to reach your destination. We can say exactly the same about our shastras, about our scriptures. Our scriptures include lots of information, but the goal is not that information. The goal is to use those scriptures like you would use a roadmap and use it to discover, in this case, discover the divinity within. Discover that when the ancient rishis said tattvamasi, they meant it, and they were right. This is the discovery phase, the second of the three phases. Let's talk briefly about the third phase, which we've called here nishtha, or assimilation. Once you've made this discovery, and the discovery usually comes in an insight. Maybe you're sitting in this lecture hall, or you're reflecting at home, or you're sitting in some other kind of pravachan, some situation, you're reflecting on these teachings, and at one instant, you figure out, hey, wait a minute. The ancient rishis are talking about me. They're not talking about some abstract philosophical reality. They're talking about me. What they mean to say is that who I am fundamentally and essentially in my heart, who I am is in fact divine. This is a whole different way of listening. Usually the way we listen is the rishis say that tat is tvam, tattvamasi. We get it in an abstract intellectual way. The rishis say that the true nature of the self is divine. That's information, is it not? Look at that statement. The rishis said that your true nature is divine. That's information. When you use the scriptures so that you can discover, hey, wait a minute, my true nature is divine, that's the purpose of the scriptures, to use the scriptures like a map to make that discovery. When that discovery finally takes place, and it may take some time, but you get it, and you realize, hey, not only is that true, it's true about me. The knowledge comes home. The knowledge applies to your experience. The knowledge applies to your life. That's why I call the second stage discovery. Vidya means knowledge, but a more profound meaning here is that discovery. Now there's a little problem, because that discovery is this momentary glimmer or insight, and so often it fades away. Suppose Suppose in the lecture hall, you get it. My true nature, you get it. Yes, I am full. I am complete. I am divine. And then after the meditation session, you go for the break and somebody gives you a funny look and you get angry. You get upset. You get hurt. Wait a minute. A few minutes ago, you were divine and full and complete. Few moments later, you're angry or hurt. What happened? Well, that discovery at the beginning seems to evaporate very quickly. Like a little glimmer, little insight, like a little spark. If you're starting a fire, you've had this experience perhaps, trying to start a fire. You get a little spark going, a little bit of flame, and then it goes out. Then you start it up again. You get a little more spark, a little bit more flame, and it goes out again. This is what seems to happen for most people initially. You get that glimmer, you get that insight, it fades away. You get it again, a little stronger, a little bit more clearly, and still it goes away. But with that fire, you know, eventually you really get it going. And the whole pile of wood or whatever it is you're burning, it all catches on fire and it just burns brightly. It just glows with such light and heat. That's the goal. That goal is described here by the term nishtha or assimilation. When this discovery comes not only as little insights, little glimmers, but when it becomes something, an abiding vision, when it's with you all the time, as it were burning brightly within you, constantly, not coming and going as little flickers, but constantly shining within you, burning within you. What it means is that that understanding, that insight about yourself is present all the time, not just when you're in this lecture hall, but even when you're driving down Route 1 and some idiot pulls in front of you, you slam on your brakes, and then you remember, but I'm divine. He's divine. He's not a very good driver, but he's divine. Being divine doesn't make you a good driver. You can appreciate that. So if that insight is with you 100% of the time, it radically transforms the way you think and behave. That's the third stage we'll call assimilation. Now, how can meditation help us? This is to introduce now our meditation session. Meditation will help at each of these three levels. First of all, meditation helps with shraddha, gaining that faith, especially if a meditation can help you begin to consider the possibility that I'm more than my body, I'm more than my mind, I'm more than my personality, I'm different from my body, mind, and personality. If meditation can begin to suggest that to you, then shraddha builds. Then, if meditation can go further, in particular, if meditation can, let's put it like this, if meditation can momentarily shut off all of the nonsense in our heads, all of the silliness that goes on in our minds from moment to moment, if meditation can just bring us a few moments of quiet, of silence, of peace, of deep contentment. In those few moments, you can have an opportunity to discover that that contentment and peace you feel is coming from where? It's not coming from outside. It's coming from you. That source of contentment and peace is within you. That source of contentment and peace is you, is the true you. That's the inner divinity. Satchidananda Atma is a Vedantic terminology used. When meditation can lead you to discover that in your experience at the time of meditation, just by making your mind quiet enough to appreciate that fullness, completeness, contentment within, that facilitates your discovery. That's the second step. And then, having discovered that, with the help of these teachings, with the help of meditation, then the assimilation takes a long time. It does take a long time. After all, you have spent decades of your life not knowing your inner divinity. So then it's going to take some time to get your mind to appreciate constantly that your true nature is divine. We have decades of habitual thinking to overcome, and a way to overcome that habitual thinking is, with meditation, to revisit that truth again and again. Every time you close your eyes, look within, and discover that divinity within, every time you do that is one step towards assimilation. You have to see it again and again and again. Slowly, that process of assimilation takes place. That's the third step. Meditation helps. Now, let's introduce a meditation that we will... This is a meditation specifically suited for this topic. There are different meditation techniques, different themes. This is a particular meditation which goes with this topic of discovering this inner divinity. The Mahavakyas, Tattvamasi, Aham Brahmasmi, etc., technically, they are not mantras. They're not meant for recitation. They're statements of fact. You don't repeat a statement of fact for meditation. Can you imagine? How about, in fact, you're like formulas. Imagine you go on repeating E equals MC squared, E equals MC squared, E equals MC squared. What will you get out of repeating a formula? Water is H2O. Water is H2O. There's a formula. You don't get anything out of repeating a formula. Our Mahavakyas really are formulas. They're not meant for meditation. They're not meant for recitation. But there's one mantra which has the same meaning as a Mahavakya. Most mantras do not have that meaning, Tattvamasi. Most meanings like Om Namo Narayanaya, salutations unto Narayana, etc. Most mantras have that structure. There is one mantra which has the same meaning as a Mahavakya. So this mantra is two words, Soham. The words in Sanskrit, we have to break the words apart a little bit better. The words are saha, which means that, and aham, which means I. Saha aham means I am that. There's our Mahavakya. But this is a Mahavakya that's meant for recitation and meditation. Saha aham, I am that, due to grammatical rules. You don't pronounce it saha aham. Those are the words. Due to grammatical rules, you pronounce it soham. And this mantra goes along with a particular pranayama technique, a very simple pranayama technique, a breathing technique, and that is the syllable so is repeated during inhalation. As you inhale, you recite mentally, so. As you exhale, you repeat mentally, hum. But now that recitation, so as you inhale, hum as you exhale, it's not just repeating syllables. These are meaningful words. So as you inhale and you're saying so in your mind, you're appreciating the divinity because of which everything exists, and as you exhale, hum, I am that. As you inhale, so. You reflect on God, Bhagavan. You reflect on the reality because of which everything exists, Brahman. As you inhale with the syllable so, and then as you exhale with the syllable hum, you reflect on the fact that the reality because of which everything exists is a reality because of which you exist. You are non-separate from the reality because of which everything exists. You are that. The divinity that gave rise to the universe gave rise to you. As you exhale with the syllable hum, which means I, a hum, as you exhale, you reflect on that in your mind. It's a very, very beautiful, important technique. So as you inhale with the syllable so, appreciating the reality because of which the universe exists, the divinity present in and through the universe, that which we call Bhagavan, you appreciate during the inhalation. And then as you exhale, you reflect on the fact that that is your reality, your inner reality, your truth. So this appreciation or reflection is meant to go on during this technique. You're not simply reciting syllables, so and hum. You have to actively reflect on the meaning. What does so mean? Who is that? What is that? Hum, ahum, I. Who am I? What is my relationship to that all-pervasive reality? This reflection is meant to go on in this meditation.